Today is Monday, April 25th, 2011. I'm not April 25th. It is July 29th, 2011. And I'm Nina Carigia.
And I'm Deacon Jones. And this is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening. It is 5:03 and it's time for a full hour of independent news. Today we'll be bringing you coverage of the ongoing U.S. debt ceiling crisis, as well as an interview with Michael Vaughn of the BCCLA. We will also have a story on Vancouver street food vendors.
All this plus headlines right here on News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news. First, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
Headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today, President Obama announced new national fuel economy standards for cars and light trucks aimed at cutting carbon emissions and the U.S. foreign oil dependency.
We've set an aggressive target, and the companies here are stepping up to the plate. By 2025, the average fuel economy of their vehicles will nearly double to almost 55 miles per gallon.
The current standard is about 28 miles per gallon. GM and Ford signed off on the deal after winning concessions for lower light truck standards. For cars, fuel efficiency will have to increase 5% every year between 2017 and 2025. Several other automakers have also signed off on the deal.
This agreement on fuel standards represents the single most important step we've ever taken as a nation to reduce our dependence on foreign oil.
As part of the agreement, there will be a reassessment of automaker progress on the standards in 2021, with changes possible if the goal seems out of reach. Environmentalists caution this and other potential loopholes could erode the agreement's poignancy. North Carolina women seeking an abortion will now find themselves having to view an ultrasound, wait 24 hours, and receive counseling. The new law comes after the state legislature overrode the governor's veto. FSRN's Linda Marie Taurasi has the story from Raleigh.
House Bill 854, a measure that Governor Beverly Perdue vocally opposed, will make it more difficult for a woman to get an abortion. The Women's Right to Know Act requires a provider to explain the size, age, and characteristics of a fetus and offer to have the pregnant woman listen to the heartbeat. Whether or not the woman chooses to look or listen must be documented, and the provider must keep that record for 7 years. The law requires counseling on abortion alternatives, including the options for adoption, welfare, or the right to sue the father for medical and financial support. After this, the woman and provider must wait 24 hours to continue with the procedure. The law also leaves a provider open to lawsuits from a woman's extended family, the father of the fetus, and even another family doctor. Under the wording of the law, even a woman's rapist could sue the abortion provider, although supporters say other state laws would prevent this from happening. Linda Marie Taurasi, FSRN, Raleigh.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 2009 that the city of New Haven had discriminated against white firefighters when it declined to certify a civil service promotional exam because no African Americans scored high enough for promotion. Now, the city and firefighters have reached a final settlement, bypassing any further litigation. From Connecticut, FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
The city declined to certify the 2003 exam because it feared being sued by African-American firefighters under the 1964 Civil Rights Act. In overturning district court and Second Circuit Court decisions that upheld the city's position, the U.S. Supreme Court in Ricci v. DiStefano established a new standard for employment law, giving more consideration to cases of so-called reverse discrimination. Over the next 2 years, New Haven will pay one Latino and 19 white firefighters a combined total of $2 million and 3 years of pension credit. Their attorneys will receive a total of $3 million. New Haven has certified the original exam results, promoting all of the eligible plaintiffs. With the settlement reached, the city is moving forward with its first public safety promotional exam since 2003, now in compliance with the new standard. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New Haven.
A hunger strike by inmates at California's Pelican Bay State Prison is over, but a solidarity group says prisoners at other facilities across the state continue their protests. FSRN's Hannah Vierkamp has more.
At least 6,600 inmates from high-security prisons across California participated in a hunger strike launched July 1st to protest prison conditions they say are inhumane. Strike leaders won several concessions, including winter hats, wall calendars, and new educational opportunities. Although the deal falls short of the strikers' original demands, Molly Portzig of Prison Hunger Strike Solidarity says these gains are significant to high-security prisoners. Portzig also notes that corrections officials originally refused to negotiate with prisoners, so the fact that an agreement was reached was in itself significant.
That's why the hunger strike leaders really do believe that this is a victory, and they're very grateful of all of the support that they have gotten so far and are just really depending on that support continuing to grow.
It is still unclear how many prisoners from other institutions are still on strike, but the Solidarity Group says inmates at Corcoran and Tehachapi state prisons continue to protest to draw attention to specific issues at those institutions. Hanna Vierkamp, FSRN, Arcata.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at FSRN.org. I'm Nina Carigia.
And I'm Deacon Jones, and it's now time for headlines.
A new silicone chip developed at UBC could drastically improve cancer research. The device allows for single-cell analysis of cancer cells by isolating cells in separate chambers to allow for more in-depth observation, says UBC's Carl Hansen, who led the team that developed the chip. Quote, single-cell genetic analysis is vital in a host of areas, including stem cell research and advanced cancer biology and diagnostics. But until now, it has been too costly to become widespread in research and especially for use in healthcare. End quote. It is hoped that the chip will help doctors to identify specific types of cancer more easily and to create a more personalized treatment program for patients.
A Kwantlen Polytechnic University professor is drawing criticism after he tweeted his disapproval of Sunday's upcoming Pride Parade. The tweet in question, posted Thursday morning, read, quote, Vancouver's so-called Pride Parade should be banned. It is vulgar, to say the least. Shinder Purewal, who was also the third-place Liberal candidate in Surrey in the last election, later clarified his comment, defending himself as a longtime supporter of gay marriage and gay rights. He stated, quote, everyone who does not like sexual display in downtown is not a hate monger. I have raised a reasonable question about one aspect of the parade. In a civilized society, let's debate as civilized people, end quote. Vancouver Pride Society President Ken Coolen responded by acknowledging that sexual aspects of the parade do exist, but stated that calling for the event to be banned came across as homophobic.
A former student body president of the First Nations University in Saskatchewan has been convicted of theft and fraud of $30,000 that occurred while he was in office. Blue Peltier was accused of repeatedly writing himself checks from the student union's bank account in 2006 and 2007, which he never repaid. Witnesses say that he used the money to purchase a car and furniture for himself. The judge ruled that the action was, quote, an aberration, end quote, in an otherwise spotless record. Peltier is required to serve an 18-month conditional sentence and repay $20,000 of the stolen $30,000 to the university's student union.
Vancouver City Council has made a new ruling to allow 17 more... Oh, excuse me, I'm so sorry. You know what? I'm in the wrong place here. My apologies. My notes are a little bit off. Where are we here? Too many papers.
We are going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.5 FM in Vancouver.
The Vancouver Fringe Festival takes place September 8th to 18th, and they're looking for volunteers. Volunteer perks include a Fringe t-shirt, a volunteer appreciation party, a rush pass redeemable for free admission to shows. The online application is now live at VancouverFringe.com.
Come spend a beautiful summer night at the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Chinese Garden and enjoy the offerings of the Enchanted Evenings concert series. July 8th, experience the unique, mind-opening, and uplifting voices of the Universal Gospel Choir. July 15th, join Buckman Coe and friends for an intimate evening of song and story exploring the most poignant moments of the classic tale of Siddhartha. July 22nd, watch Jackie Asombe and Pepe Danza heat up the summer night with a percussion-driven dance performance. July 29th, Mark Damisch and his family will present an exciting evening of Gershwin, Copland, and other favorites featuring melodic piano and harmonious vocals. On top of all this, don't miss the Seven Tyrants Theatre Society's A Good Woman of Setswan, playing June 29th through July 24th. It's all happening at the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Chinese Garden. For tickets and more information, visit VancouverChineseGarden.com.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, as well as online, streaming at www.citr.ca. Now, to continue on with our headlines, Vancouver City Council has approved a report that will now take immediate action into the public safety of pedestrians on Vancouver streets. The report outlines a detailed trial plan, which will be implemented between Jackson and Abbott Streets on Hastings Street in downtown Eastside. The plan is to create a pedestrian safety zone by reducing speed limits to 30 kilometers per hour, installing speed reader boards, and adding countdown timers to crosswalks in the area. The trial zone includes the intersection of Main and Hastings, known to have the highest rate of pedestrian and vehicle collisions in the city. If this trial is successful, many similar safety zones will be set up around the city.
It's now time for a story from CITR reporter Iqbal Ahmed, who had a chance to interview Michael Vaughn from the BCCLA.
Can you please tell us a little bit about the Medical Marijuana Access Program and the changes that Health Canada is preparing to make to it?
Sure. So right now, the Medical Marijuana Access Program is in a state of crisis. In fact, it has been for a long time. But just recently, we had a court decision out of Ontario that struck it down, and not for the first time, as unconstitutional. And the reason for that was, it's called the Murnau case. And in that case, the court found that it is almost impossible to find a doctor, even if you are a qualifying patient, who will sign the necessary forms. So the court in that case struck down the regulations, and so Health Canada and the government has to fashion a new set. And so their proposal is to do a number of things, including get Health Canada out of the business of providing any authorization whatsoever. Right now it's a two-part process where the doctor says, yes, this is authorized, and then Health Canada also has to issue an authorization.
Mm-hmm.
So the best part of this proposal is actually to get Health Canada out of there. As far as we can tell, all that added to the process was many months waiting time,
okay,
and no actual benefit. So they said, like, yeah, let's get ourselves out of this business. And that's the best part of their proposal.
Mm-hmm.
Other aspects of their proposal are, well, you know, if doctors are having a hard time appreciating the medical benefits of marijuana, we'll undertake an education program for them. That's what they're proposing to do about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they say that what they want to do is they want to eliminate the ability for patients to grow their own medical marijuana or indeed to designate someone to grow for them, and that what they are proposing is to institute a licensed, commercial licensed facilities for production. Mm-hmm. So the way that would work is you'd get a prescription from your doctor. Again, Health Canada is out of the picture, mm-hmm. and then you would send away to one of these licensed facilities, and they would provide you with dried marijuana in the mail as per your prescription. So that's what they're proposing.
Mm-hmm. How would these licensed distributors differ from dispensaries that already exist?
Well, I suppose one route would be that they could, in fact, license a dispensary, but that does not seem to be what they have in mind, and that's one of our criticisms of their proposal. It is very, very clear and has been clear for many years now that the success story in medical marijuana, the success story in actually providing access to these needed medications is community-based dispensaries, known more commonly as compassion clubs. And they are not the kinds of facilities that seems to be what Health Canada had in mind. They are distribution centers. And there is no provision for a distribution center in the proposal that Health Canada has right now. Mm-hmm. But that's problematic, we say, for a whole bunch of reasons. One, of course, they're the established models. They already exist. And to build on an established model means that we can fix this problem fast. Mm-hmm. So that's important. But two, there's also this sense of Health Canada doesn't seem to want to have an actual interaction between the distribution center and the patient. They want to do this either through the mail or through courier. And that's just not the way that we conduct the standard of care for people receiving medications. Mm-hmm. Any other medication prescription that you get, somebody is there to answer your questions and go through the sheet of what you should do or shouldn't do. And that's a critically important aspect of care. For medical marijuana, you can imagine if this is being prescribed to someone for, you know, pick one of the places it could be prescribed for the fallout, the devastating fallout of chemotherapy, to help people eat, to help them keep their food down, to help them keep weight on, all of those things. The chances of somebody knowing how to effectively smoke or ingest marijuana are actually quite small. Somebody has to show you how to do that, and quite frankly, at this juncture, it is certainly not your family doctor who is undertaking those kinds of services. Compassion clubs are, and they are already established, and they have a proven track record. So, you know, it's quite suspicious, I would say, that Health Canada has not chosen to implicitly want to build on the one thing in this situation that we've got to, you know, be our foundational structure. Rather, they're suggesting something that they would have to invent from the ground up, or indeed they do have a bit of a pilot or a bit of a model for this, because Health Canada does have right now one designated licensed production facility, and we would have to say on the basis of its track record thus far, it has proved to be very unsatisfactory to patients. So why they would want to build on the unsatisfactory model when the proven model already exists seems to be much more based on stereotype and stigma than it would be on evidence.
So you feel that they're kind of opposition to using these community-based dispensaries is based on just not really on any evidence, but more on what they perceive these to be, that they don't feel that these are legitimate ways to get medicine?
Well, you know, certainly, as I say, it's quite suspicious that they are so resoundingly silent on the subject when they're the obvious place to begin building in our submission. But also, you know, to characterize this submission, or rather this proposal by Health Canada, I think we do have to address the fact that it is quite rife with something that I would suggest looks a lot like stigma. You can imagine, you know, there are unpublished studies right now that do surveys of patients who are already incredibly burdened by the criminalization of marijuana outside of the medical context. The difficulty of accessing medical marijuana, the difficulty of facing the societal stigma even if you do access it completely legally. Mm-hmm. After all, your ability to smoke your medication in a facility of any kind, including your own home if you're a renter, is always at risk. It's always suspect. Mm-hmm. So those concerns are front and center. And instead of actually grappling with this and Health Canada saying, we have to help patients deal with the stigma and the barriers to use of their medication. Instead, what Health Canada has done is effectively contributed to that stigma, in our opinion, mm-hmm. by suggesting that people who use medical marijuana present a risk, a safety and security risk in their communities. Mm-hmm. And so, they say things like, we don't want people to grow medical marijuana in their communities because, of course, that's either a security risk in and of itself, mm-hmm. safety and security, or else it attracts people who are trying to rip off medical grow facilities.
Do you think the stigma is also a reason why doctors haven't been prescribing it maybe as much as they should have? That it
absolutely. Mm-hmm. Not even a question in our minds. and that's one of the reasons why we say, so decades of lingering stigma and stereotyping is not going to be very readily combated by Health Canada saying, well, we'll publish some good information. Mm-hmm. We'll send around some brochures, and then everybody will get on board, and everybody will have a physician who will understand these questions. It's simply insufficient. Mm-hmm. Not only is it insufficient, if it ever were sufficient, it would take a very long time for that education campaign to, get down to the level where it's actually making behavior change. Mm-hmm. Quite frankly, people have already been suffering for years, and there's a need right now. So what we say is, given that there's been so little participation by physicians, Canadian physicians, and their various organizations have been very, very vocal about saying they don't really, they don't want to be the gatekeepers of this program. It's pretty obvious that we need other kinds of medical health professionals to be able to authorize the use of medical marijuana.
And what do you
such
think?
As nurse practitioners, that would be one example.
Mm-hmm. So how far do you think this should go, that who in the medical community is qualified to offer medical marijuana prescriptions and who is not? Because once you get into a gray area to have doctors, I feel that some people fear that it'll become too readily available.
Well, I'll tell you, it hasn't been our problem thus far.
Mm-hmm.
What we've got right now is we've got approximately, according to surveys that are done, we've got about 1 million people in Canada who have used, do require, would find beneficial medical marijuana.
Wow.
How many have actually managed to be certified through Health Canada's program is less than 10,000.
Wow.
So we have a long way to go before we're in the realm of this being something that's too readily available.
Mm-hmm.
We are so far in the other direction that when we have that happy problem, we can deal with it. But that is not our issue. Our issue right now is suffering patients who cannot get access. And so that, and because they have a constitutional right to that access, that is the problem that Health Canada should be addressing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, great. Thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
And
nice to be here.
Is there anything else you'd want to add before we let you go?
No, it just seems that there's a deep irony that we had a raid on a compassion club
mm-hmm.
Within the last 36 hours. Given that, this is the last week for the public to make submissions on how to make this program work and be better,
mm-hmm.
Obviously we've got a lot of work to do.
Okay, great.
Okay, right. Thanks a lot.
Okay, have a great day. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks for that story, Iqbal. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. I'm Nina Kurgia, and you're listening to CITR News 101.
And sorry about that. Our computers are experiencing some technical difficulties right now. So just wait a second. We'll get these PSAs all fired up. And Justin, actually today I'd like to announce that we have two new contributors. As you already heard, Nina and Duncan.
Deacon.
If you guys just want to introduce yourself.
Well, we are
both second years.
both second-year students at the University of British Columbia.
Woohoo!
Arts faculty.
Yeah, arts. Sorry, I'm very arts enthusiast.
Okay, well, thank you for that little insight to your lives, guys. We're going to take another commercial break. We are back. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting at the Student Union Building in the University of British Columbia.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will net you discounts in the Westside UBC area at Banyan Books, The Bike Kitchen, The Eatery, Fresh's Best Salsa, Gumdrops, Kerner's Pub, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and West Coast Music.
And don't forget the UBC Bookstore. It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or visit us online at citr.ca.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM and online at www.citr.ca live stream. We have another story now from Iqbal, our News 101 reporter, on the debt ceiling crisis that the United States is currently experiencing.
Offer some background on the current issue of the U.S. debt ceiling.
Well, the U.S. government needs to pass a bill in order to increase the total amount of the national debt that is permitted on periodic occasions, depending upon how big a budget deficit it's running.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been doing that for many, many years. There have been probably about 100, I don't know the exact number, occasions when the debt ceiling has been increased in much the same way. There is a very serious long-term problem of excessive debt, and pretty much everybody agrees that it has to be addressed and has to be brought down. But in the short run, there's no doubt that the debt ceiling has to be raised, because the U.S. government's just not in a position to immediately stop borrowing and be able to pay off all of its existing creditors and meet its obligations for things like Social Security checks and, mm-hmm. and the military and so forth. Mm-hmm. So the short-run situation is that if the United States does not raise the debt ceiling, it will fail to pay many of its bills, including failing to make pay off the bonds that are due. Mm-hmm. You know, so it will default on bonds. And the crucial thing is that that will terribly severely affect the ratings of the U.S. bonds mm-hmm. in the bond market, and raise interest rates that the U.S. government has to pay. And because those are kind of the basis for other interest rates, raise mm-hmm. interest rates in the economy in general, and hurt the value of existing bonds all over the world. So it's a catastrophe and it doesn't pass.
Mm-hmm. Talk about U.S. bond ratings. Didn't Standard & Poor's recently announced that they'd be revising the rating put on U.S. bonds?
They've been threatening to do it. They have mm-hmm. not lowered the rating. It's still it's AAA,
uh-huh.
But they're saying that certainly if the U.S. government would default, then it would change considerably the bond ratings. And they've also been saying that if the U.S. government doesn't adopt a measure to reduce the long-term debt, then it would also lower the debt ratings, the bond ratings. But that's not something that has to happen in the next couple of days.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like this round of debates on raising the debt ceiling, like you said, they've done it so many times in the past. What makes it different this time around?
Well, the reason it's different is mostly that considerable group of Republicans have decided to kind of hold the debt ceiling hostage
mm-hmm.
In order to force Democrats and the president to adopt policies that they prefer for solving the long-term debt crisis. So you've got a group of members, especially in the House of Representatives, who seem to be willing, or at least they're acting as if they're willing, to allow the government to default if the others in the political system, the Democrats in the Senate and the President, don't agree to their specific proposals for how to reduce long-term debt. And the essence of that is that they want to do those reductions of long-term debt entirely by cutting spending, primarily on domestic programs, and not at all by raising taxes.
Yeah, it seems like it's a very high-stakes game of political chicken going on right now in D.C.
That's correct. It's a game of chicken is a good analogy for what it is.
And it seems like almost both sides, they have these competing plans, the Democrats and the Republicans, and like you said, the Republican plan wants to, I mean, they both aim to reduce the deficit, don't they?
Yes. Both, everyone agrees that the, let me correct that a little bit. Because the United States is still struggling to get out of a recession, many, many people, including most Democrats, don't think that there ought to be budget cuts that actually have their impact very quickly. Everyone agrees that there needs to be substantial restructuring and reduction of budget deficits over the longer run, and agrees that there ought to be decisions now, or in the short run, decisions soon, that would take their effect later, and that would show that the government was on a path toward getting deficits under control.
And can you just give our listeners a bit of background, because there is so much talk about these two competing plans, the Democratic plan and the Republican plan, and the Republicans, I believe today or yesterday, announced that they were going to delay a vote.
Actually, just in the last hour or so, I don't know exactly the time, they have held that vote again, and the House did pass the Republican measure that they had, same one that they had delayed on.
Oh, really?
Yesterday.
But then the Senate's were controlled by the Democrats, correct?
That's right.
So do they believe? Do John Boehner and the Republicans feel that they have enough votes in the Senate to get it past the second house?
No. I don't think anybody thinks there's any possibility that it will pass as is in the Senate. The distinctive feature of this, I think, is that is compared with the way U.S. government worked in situations in the past where we've had divided control of the institutions, that is, one party in control of the presidency and another in control of Congress, or one party in control of the House and another in control of the Senate. The thing that's different about this, I think, is that when policy actions were really critical and obviously necessary in the past, either institution or any of the institutions would take it upon themselves to try to develop a proposal that they thought the other party, you know, the other institution could possibly accept. The difference from the usual pattern is that the House Republicans have, for the most part, been saying the only thing that they will accept is spending cuts with no tax cuts. And they also have insisted that the debt limit increase be a relatively small one. That won't sound small. It's close to $1 trillion. But one that would only permit the government to keep operating on the basis of the existing budget until sometime early next year, which would mean that it would have to, the whole issue of raising the debt limit would have to be addressed again during the presidential election campaign. And the Democrats have opposed that, both because of the economic disruption that is possible with this bill, as we've already seen, mm-hmm. and on partisan grounds, the Republicans want that shorter debt limit increase because they think it'll hurt the president to have to push for a debt limit increase during the presidential election year. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats' position is partly partisan in the same way. That is, they want to avoid that this difficulty for Obama during the presidential election year.
This seems almost like a repeat of the budget talks that happened quite recently, where they couldn't come to a consensus, so they kind of just pushed it down a little further.
Yeah, well, except that this actually has to happen, or you have a disaster. With mm-hmm. in American government, you pretty often have had an inability to pass a budget, and what they then do is pass a continuing resolution, which basically says there won't be any changes. We'll just keep doing. All the agencies will keep spending what they've been spending,
mm-hmm.
and they keep putting it off further and further. Now, the relations between the parties are so difficult that this has been happening. That is, the inability to pass budgets, appropriations bills. This has been happening to an extraordinary degree, and this Congress hasn't been passing any appropriations bills. Mm-hmm. It's just been passing these measures that are supposed to be temporary mm-hmm. extensions.
Do you think a part of the reason that the two parties haven't been able to come together consensus is this new almost, I guess on the Republican side, and they're recently being gaining the majority in the House, and the newfound kind of freshman Tea Party senators who are maybe pushing John Boehner in this direction?
Yes, I think that's right. That is something that's important that's happening in both parties is that ideological activists of various kinds are becoming more influential. On the Democratic side, you have groups like MoveOn.org, who are managing to generate hundreds of thousands of, or even millions of emails to members of Congress about matters that they are concerned with, and they're generally pushing for a strong, kind of more left-wing position.
Mm-hmm.
And on the Republican side, it's conservative activists, and in recent years, it was often religious fundamentalist Christian conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
But the most recent thing is the Tea Party, and which is basically anti-government more than social conservatism.
Mm-hmm.
And they played a big role in the 2010 midterm elections and have a lot of influence with a lot of members of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And the party that they influence is the Republicans, and the Republicans did take over control of the House of Representatives. So what you're saying is correct, I think, that as the House of Representatives controlled by Republicans influenced by the Tea Party is the kind of core of what's happening right now.
Mm-hmm. And just one last question. So looking forward, what do you think will happen from here with the Republicans passing their bill from the House, which will most likely fail in the Senate, then maybe go back to the House? And how do you see this playing out?
Well, it's not completely clear, but what the Democrats are intending to do is to change the Boehner bill to terms they find more acceptable. I don't know whether they will whether they'll compromise somehow on this, on the differences between them. It's hard to compromise on the key point about how big an increase in the debt ceiling mm-hmm. there is, and whether it's enough for 1 year or two. That's a big difference. But they will amend it and then try to pass it in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not easy because the Senate really requires 60 out of 100 votes because of the filibuster rule in the Senate. And so they're talking about, they're trying to count votes and wondering whether they'll have enough Republicans who are willing to go along with it. I think the prospects for that are quite good. They're talking about, they're mentioning the Republicans who they think will support it, and I think their reasoning is quite reasonable. So I think it's fairly likely that the Democratic Senate will pass this amendment to the major amendments to the Boehner bill, and then they'll send it back to the House. And the interesting question then is whether Boehner is willing to go forward with it and take it to the floor of the House. If it goes to the floor of the House, he can probably pass it because most of the Democrats in the House would pass it.
Mm-hmm.
But this would be an unusual thing for him to take a bill to the floor of the House with the expectation that most of the support for it would come from the opposite party.
He will likely
be in the situation of having to decide between, on the one hand, passing a measure really sponsored by and supported mostly by the other party, undermining his own party's position, or else having the House of Representatives be seen as responsible for a failure to extend the debt limit and the government defaulting on its bonds.
So it's interesting. So it kind of depends on who they think the public will pin the blame on. Maybe.
Well, yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot of that. That is, in a sense, the you have two institutions, the Senate and the House, and the one that can put the ball in the other institution's court last.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at a point when there's, if they don't buy it, then you get default. They would have the advantage. Another possibility, by the way, is that they'll agree to a very, very short measure that merely extends the debt limit, just for maybe even they've talked about even as little as a couple of days, to give them time for to negotiate something more carefully that might have more of the aspect of a genuine compromise between the two houses.
Is there a specific date by which they have to come to a decision before the U.S. starts defaulting on all its debts?
Apparently, by the end of August 2nd, that's the Tuesday, they would need to have new borrowing authority, or the Treasury Department is going to be unable to pay some bills.
All right, great. Well, thank you for your time, Professor Quirk.
You're welcome.
And have a great day.
You too.
Bye. And that was actually me giving a quick interview with Professor Paul Quirk of the University of British Columbia on the ongoing drama on Capitol Hill about the United States debt ceiling and the kind of the future of just this gridlock that's happening right now. We're going to take another quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, and this is News 101.
Industrial noise and goth. Tune into the Vampire's Ball. Midnight, 4 a.m. Friday nights, right here at 101.9 CITR FM in Vancouver. www.citr.ca.
I can listen to them and go, this is ridiculous. And people don't make music like this. They never have, and they never will. This is really cool stuff, and people don't make music like this, and they never have, and they never will.
Probably the closest to my heart.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and online at www.citr.ca. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about the new ruling on Vancouver food carts. So the Vancouver City Council has made a new ruling to allow 17 more food carts onto the streets this year. This decision has been widely received by the citizens of Vancouver as a positive choice for the city. One of the supporters of this ruling to increase the number of food carts on the streets is Cordon Bleu trained chef Lisa Faulkner.
I think it's long overdue and terrific addition to the downtown food scene. I'm really excited about it.
When asked about the quality of food coming off these carts, Chef Faulkner commented that the food can easily match restaurant quality and is perfect for eating on the run.
Where you're taking this food or why it's being served from a food truck, it's so that it can be portable, so that it's the kind of food that you want to take on a picnic or eat on a park bench somewhere. And in terms of quality, I think, as a matter of fact, the quality of the food is excellent, and the imagination that's going behind the preparation of the food and what's being served is all outstanding. But I think it's comparable to a restaurant right outdoors.
And ultimately, the decision to increase the number of food carts on the streets of Vancouver has been long awaited by many, just as it has with Chef Faulkner. The city plans to continue this expansion of the food cart program even further over the next few years.
Thank you very much for that story, Deke. We're going to actually throw it back to FSRN, and we're going to hear a story on Egypt and canal workers, a strike that the canal workers have put on in this new post-Mubarak era that this very exciting part of the world is taking part in.
In Cairo's Tahrir Square, tens of thousands of people, including the biggest turnout so far of representatives of Islamist political groups, have taken part in a mass rally to express their frustration at the slow pace of democratic reform. Meanwhile, across the country, skilled labourers have been engaging in strikes and demonstrations for better wages and treatment, hoping that in the post-Mubarak era, their demands will no longer fall on deaf ears. David Enders reports from Suez and Ismailia, Egypt.
Even though workers have more room to organize here than they have had in decades, some are already disappointed in a failure to turn that freedom into tangible gains. Among them are workers from seven companies along the Suez Canal that have been demonstrating and striking since the beginning of June in search of higher pay and better benefits. The workers are considering a serious escalation of their tactics, says Mohamed Hamzawi, a union leader and employee at the Al Timsa Shipbuilding Company in Ismailia.
At the beginning, we were just chanting and holding banners up. Now we are blocking roads and entering offices to talk to people. The only thing left is the use of force. Despite the giant losses that are occurring, they are refusing to implement this agreement.
The strike has already cost the canal and the support companies millions of dollars, and some boats remain stranded or unable to leave dry dock after receiving repairs. Of the nearly 10,000 employees of the seven companies, thousands have participated in work stoppages. As Hamzawi spoke, a pair of striking workers approached who were on their way to report to the military prosecutor in the city. Nasser Bardisi was one of those who had been summoned for questioning.
I expect I'll be charged with halting production, but Labor Law 12, passed in 2003, gives me the right to strike peacefully.
The workers began striking after an agreement to raise wages by 40%, made with Ahmed Fadl, the head of the Suez Canal Authority in April, was not implemented. Workers repeatedly said they were demanding the same treatment and pay as those who work directly for the state-run Suez Canal Authority, which contracts the services of the support companies to maintain the canal and the boats and other infrastructure used for maintenance. Nadia Youssef is also an employee of Al Timsa Company.
It's very highly skilled labor. At the same time, the authority takes profits that are earned by these companies and these workers. We see none of the profits. The strike is escalating and growing, so the losses are increasing. We want to know why Fadl is going back on the agreement. The workers here get no housing or health care or any of the perks that the authority workers get, like access to beaches and access to certain clubs.
Yusuf and three others were taken in for questioning by the Egyptian military after the demonstration. They were released the following day. Some workers have threatened to prevent ships from passing through the canal, which sees average traffic of more than 50 ships a day and generates more than $1 billion annually for Egypt. Labor unrest is nothing new in Suez or Egypt. Despite a 1942 law banning unions that were not approved by the government, thousands of strikes and demonstrations have occurred in the last 2 decades, and at least 3 independent unions had formed before the demonstrations that drove former President Hosni Mubarak from power. Since Mubarak was removed, 42 more unions have been formed. But by some accounts, the Egyptian military, which is currently in control of the country, is harsher toward labor organizers than the Mubarak regime. Such controls were in evidence in Suez, where plainclothes military intelligence officers kept tabs on workers who were speaking to journalists. Mohamed Hamad, an employee of the Suez Arsenal Company, was questioned by a military intelligence officer. He explained to the officer that this was the protocol before speaking to journalists.
I spoke to Colonel Ahmed from your office. I don't remember his last name. This is his number. I think you know this number very well. 012-272-2222. We coordinated with them regarding the things we are going to say in this interview. We will finish and call you.
The canal company workers have temporarily gone back to work, mollified by a promise from government officials to raise wages when a new parliament is seated. But already this week, new unrest broke out in Ismailia, when workers at a manufacturing plant clashed with police on Tuesday as they were demanding higher wages. David Enders for FSRN, Suez and Ismailia, Egypt.
Thank you for FSRN for bringing us those headlines, for that newscast. Full newscast and many more very interesting casts can be found on FSRN.org. I'm Iqbal Ahmed with the News 101, and I'm actually going to take a moment and expand on the interview that we had just aired a few minutes ago with Professor Paul Cork on the U.S. debt ceiling, because actually since that interview no more than about maybe 2 hours ago, there have been new developments in the issue. So as you might have heard in our interview, the Republicans did pass their debt reduction and ceiling increase plan. And this actually passed by a vote of 218-210, which is, you know, an 8-vote margin to pass the lower house, which Republicans control. So now the issue has to go to the Senate, which is controlled by the Democratic Party, who opposed the Republican plan. So the Republican plan, as you might have remembered, is deficit reduction through cutting funding for different programs and no tax increases. That's kind of their red line, is that they don't want any more taxing increases to combat the budget. And so the Republican plan would initially cut about $900 billion and lift the debt ceiling only enough to last a few months. So a big contingency on this is that this issue would have to come back up possibly during President Obama's presidential re-election campaign, which the Democrats, in a partisan manner, are not too keen on. And so the Senate Democratic leader, Harry Reid, has said that his short-term deal solution is very unacceptable, and he will push his own bill that would cut $2.2 trillion of spending over the next 10 years. So this is coming down to a battle between John Boehner and the House Republican and Harry Reid and the Senate. And only when a single bill passes both houses will there actually be President Obama can sign it into law. And another interesting thing is that this whole debate has raised the prospect that the United States will lose its top-notch AAA credit rating from Standard & Poor's, which would hurt U.S. bondholders, which would almost even make this entire crisis even worse if they don't come to a consensus by Tuesday, as Professor Cork has said. It's another important thing to say is that Harry Reid has essentially said that this Republican bill is dead on arrival in the Senate. So the Senate will make amendments or shoot it down completely, and then have to go back to the House, where the Republicans will have to pass it. And then the Republicans will have to make an identical bill pass through both And as Professor Quirk was saying, it's kind of a blame game going on as to who's left with the very end, and whoever they see is blocking the passing of the bill will receive the blame and be hurt politically before the election. So that's just a quick update on everything that's happened since that interview over an hour ago. We're going to take another quick commercial break, but you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the Student Union Building in the University of British Columbia.
Get to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
You talking to me? You talking to me?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Just a sweet transvestite. From trans.
Where else can you see Hollywood blockbusters, midnight cult classics, indie films, live music, burlesque, stand-up comedy, poetry slams, and live sporting events all at your local theater? The Rio Theater, voted number one in East Vancouver. Your neighborhood indie theater that promotes all things cool.
This month, catch Cowboys and Aliens from the 1st through the 11th, a Harry Potter retrospective the 15th through 17th, lots of zombies on the 21st, and awesome midnight movies every Friday.
For more information, go to riotheater.ca.
Welcome back to CITR News 101. I am Deacon Jones, and that's our program for July 29th, 2011. Today's newscast was produced by Iqbal Ahmed and brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITR News. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at CITR.ca. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101.
From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.